intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Dare to Think Out Loud. Or just Dare to Think, damn it. That works pretty well too. Here we are on Friday, the 21st of May, year 2021. Year of insanity. At least the last 14 to 15 months certainly appear to be insanity. Well, I'm here today with my trusty producer, Dave Scorpio, from down south of the equator, and with my good friend, Cal Robbins, from out there in the Lake Havasu, Arizona area. So, Dave, to kick off what we're about to jump into here, which will be a discussion of who were the anti-federalists and why is it important, how about you telling the folks about how they can help keep this platform for free speech alive and kicking?
Sure, Mike. Good to be on with you and Cal. Well, as everyone knows, free speech is certainly under attack in every area of people's lives right now. But Revolution Radio remains a bastion of free speech. So come aboard and help keep this platform moving ahead. And remember, nobody is making money from the station. The hosts do it for free, and so do the management. So keep that in mind. Come aboard freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Go on the Patreon button there, become a Patreon member, and give what you can. Or scroll down to the bottom of the front page, and there's an actual physical address where you can mail in donations the old-fashioned way.
Hey, thanks, Dave. How are things down there south of the equator?
Well, things are very calm here. It's funny, you know, they're trying to punish Ecuador because Ecuador has only ordered something like 250,000 vaccines total for a country of 25 million. So they're trying to say, oh, there's another outbreak. Ecuador is really in bad shape, but it's all fantasy. They have a vaccine station opened up nearby where I live, and usually it's completely empty. I see maybe, you know, three or four people there on occasion. But, you know, it just seems like nobody cares anymore. I think what it comes down to, Mike, is most people don't know anyone that's sick. So it's hard to be afraid, you know, when you don't know anyone that's ever gotten sick from it.
Well, I think the desperation's beginning to show, Dave, because now on TV we have rap stars offering free Uber rides for people who will take the vaccine. I think that's pretty indicative if you have to dip to that level. I mean, I remember telling my daughter years ago she couldn't play rap music in the house because it sounded like feeding time at the zoo.
That's about right. And so, Mike, you got to wonder, where's all this money coming from for the free rides and the free ice cream and free donuts, free groceries, gift cards? Where'd all this money coming from?
Exactly. And that was a question I brought up yesterday on Do-It-Yourself Health with Jim Ram, Sergeant Jim Ram. And I asked the question because we had our favorite county commissioner from Ohio on with us, Brad Peoples. And we were talking about the push in that rural county for the vaccine. And, of course, then we had to bring up the fact that the governor of Ohio has offered a lottery. If you will come in and take the vaccine, you will be enrolled in a lottery for $1 million. And so my question was, where in constitutionally does the governor have the right to collect money, taxpayers' money, and give it away in a raffle or a lottery for people who take the vaccine? And of course, Jim says, well, I've looked into that, and he's saying that it is the COVID relief money. And I said, oh, so he's taking the money that allegedly went out there to help businesses and people who suffered because of shutdowns and all of this other stuff, he's taking that money and offering it as a prize for the vaccine.
That's outrageous.
And we talked about that. And then, of course, the governor of Ohio has also said if you are between the ages of 12 and 18 and you will come and take the vaccine, you will be enrolled in a lottery for a free education at the college of your choice in Ohio. So he's got two programs going on. Stop and think about this. If a person was in the hospital with a very serious condition, cancer, a heart attack, or what have you, do you think you would have to offer them a chance at $1 million for a cure? To try a cure?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Well, Mike, I've never seen anything like this, the desperation to get everyone to take this shot. And you know, they're going to give it to school children, even though they openly admit that school children have pretty much no chance of getting the disease to begin with. Yet they want to vaccinate all school children by next year. So you got to wonder what the real agenda is, Mike.
Well, exactly. And I saw this morning where Oregon has put up a mandate that you cannot shop in Oregon, cannot go into a business unless you've been vaccinated.
Wow.
So, and that kind of aligns with the fact that seven or eight counties in Oregon have offered to secede from Oregon and join Idaho.
Wow. God. So yeah, Mike, it's just, you got to wonder what they're really up to, man. I it's bizarre.
We're seeing some interesting dynamics here. Hey, Cal, out there in Lake Havasu, what's the news on your front about this absolute insanity?
Well, the insanity just continues out here as well. So, some places, they still want you to wear masks. Other places don't care. I don't know. Like I say, I feel like I'm living in some alternate reality anymore. The depth of, I don't know, insanity, stupidity, willingness to accept whatever they're told just without question. I just shake my head and try to avoid these people anymore.
Well, Cal, you probably saw it, but I posted on Facebook the analogy that taking this vaccine is playing Russian roulette with your health. With your life, And the warning is, if you don't play Russian roulette with your life, you might die.
Yeah, that's fitting, you know.
Well, I feel like I'm living in bizarro world for sure. I mean, this is getting absolutely incredibly stupid.
Yeah, it's an insult to anybody's, you know, if you have a cognitive ability or any intelligence at all, it's just, everything going on is just an insult to anybody with any intellect.
What was that old adage? I can't remember who said it now, but never be surprised at the stupidity of people in large groups.
No doubt. And, you know, guys, they're already talking about when will people need a booster shot?
Well, that's obvious. And someone else I was reading this morning, someone else was talking about the binary effect. Someone stepped up on that and said, well, you know, they may be giving some of these people the first part of a binary, and then the second will come along later. I'm trying to find that now as I speak. It was, yes, it says, Dr. Lee Merritt explains how mRNA vaccines killed animals during testing and how mRNA vaccines could be used to kill millions of people by first injecting people with a so-called vaccine and then releasing a counterpart even years or months or years later to where the people could be killed at will. And so Dr. Lee Merritt calls this a binary poison. Of course, we have the evidence that we have talked about before, Dave, on your program about how the polio vaccine was, in fact, a binary that later really increased the number of cancer cases that came about in the country.
Yeah. And it's people, you know, they always leave out the fact this is all, you know, emergency use. So there's no liability whatsoever for the companies or the government. And people seem to forget that little fact.
Well, I hate to break people's hearts here, but did you guys see where Trump was on? I think it was CNN where he said he was the father of this vaccine and that it he should be given the credit and that that he was very upset that they stopped the production with the Johnson & Johnson because that should have never happened because that is what led people to question the efficacy of the vaccine. And that it was he that put all of the pressure on Fauci and the CDC to get this vaccine done and how they fought back against him, but he prevailed. Have you seen that yet, guys?
Yeah, he said they should call it the Trump vaccine, the Trump zine, I think.
And he was very much claiming credit that this thing wouldn't be here now. The vaccine wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him.
Yeah.
Well, now how is Q going to spend that?
Well, Mike, it's interesting how the Republicans and Democrats always agree on the really important issues.
Oh gosh! Don't make me laugh, Dave. Please. Are you gentlemen ready to
hold on, Mike? I gotta stretch my brain to do some of these mental gymnastics. Hold on a minute.
Okay, stretch them out there. Stretch them out there, Cal.
I gotta stretch out my gray matter to do these mental gymnastics. Holy cow!
It's absolutely unreal. But I'm still waiting to hear how the Q people are going to say, well, you know, once we prove this election fraud and Trump comes back in, all vaccines will be mandatory.
Oh man.
What else can they say? He is the father of the vaccine. And he said, unfortunately, some of the people who are resisting this thing were the people who voted for him. Unfortunately, so.
Oh wow, that's amazing.
Yep.
He just tried to pull us. He's still leading these people around by their noses.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Well, I saw a clip of the chief of I saw a clip of the chief of the CEO of Pfizer talking about people needing a booster in 8 to 12 months. That's like the, you know, the CEO of GM telling you you need to buy a new car.
I don't know. We're going to have to start calling each other at 5 a.m. so we can do our mental gymnastics.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if I don't get this brain stretched out, I'm not going to be able to accept any of this crap. So, gentlemen, are you ready to jump into the topic for today?
Yes, sir.
All right. Who were the Anti-Federalists? Well, it appears that the term Anti-Federalist didn't come about until the Constitution was sent out and made public for the first time in 1787. When the Constitution that had been prepared by the people who called themselves Federalist, who weren't any more Federalist than Federal Express, pushed it through, they got it signed, they got it sent to the states for ratification, and immediately multitudes of people began to see that this thing had some serious faults in it, some serious flaws. And so almost immediately they started writing articles. They had a heck of a time trying to get them published. About one quarter of the newspapers of the time would not touch an Anti-Federalist writing. So the best way to demonize them, as we do now, as you know, we call people conspiracy theorists and homophobes and all this other stuff, which puts them into a category, all of them together, so they can be demonized. Back then, they just came up with the phrase Anti-Federalist. They didn't call them freedom fighters. They didn't call them liberty folks. They didn't call them the Sons of Liberty. They called them Anti-Federalist to cast a negative viewpoint on them. So the Anti-Federalists began to come out of almost everywhere. And there were multitudes of these people. Now, I would remind you that when it came to the Federalists, there were three. And basically, it ended up being two after John Jay got hit with a brick while riding in his carriage. I'm not sure who threw the brick, but as one professor said, it was a missile from God. So John Jay was taken out of the battle. So it was Madison and Hamilton who did the advertising campaign while they were countered with a multitude of people who were called Anti-Federalist. Now, interestingly, in the 1820s, 1830s, somewhere in that time frame, Anti-Federalists ceased to be mentioned in any books or historical studies or even in lectures in academia. The Anti-Federalists disappeared in American history for over 100 years. Now, the question would be, why? Why were they suddenly written out of history? If they were so wrong, and if they missed the boat so bad, why were they written out of history? But then, and ironically, it was a lady professor, Dr. Cecilia Kenyon, in the 1950s, who decided she would go on a bashing program of the Anti-Federalists, which she did under the title of O Ye Men of Little Faith. And what she did was probably what she wished she had never done, is she put a crack into the veneer, and the people started looking around. Some of the historians, including Herbert J. Storing, started looking around and said, well, who were these people? Who's she talking about? So they started doing research. And Storing comes up with a book, several books, called The Complete Anti-Federalist, which was not complete, unfortunately. But he covered a great number of the Anti-Federalists and their objections to the Constitution. And of course, then one of my favorites is Saul Cornell, S-A-U-L-C-O-R-N-E-L-L, and his book, The Other Founders. And he covers it quite extensively, and he does quite a bit of background on the Anti-Federalist, including the fact that while the Federalists, those who proposed and endorsed the Constitution, they came from what Alexander Hamilton referred to as the wealthy and the well-born, or the aristocracy. You did not find Federalists in the middle class, what was called the yeoman class, and you did not find Federalists in the lower working class, the farmers, the agrarians. You didn't find them there. But with the Anti-Federalists, you found some who were so almost illiterate in some of their writings. If you really get into the Anti-Federalists, I mean, they really had problems spelling anything. And you could tell that they were just, you know, almost illiterate. But they were opposing the Constitution. But it went all the way through all strata of society, even up to the rich. The wealthy wrote against adoption of the Constitution. So who was better represented in their viewpoints, the Federalists or the Anti-Federalists? So, Cal, you want to jump in?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, with the Anti-Federalists, you know, being represented by a full cross-section of the people of the time back then, it is amazing how their words, their thoughts, and their opinions have been totally discounted, you know. I mean, even to this day, I mean, you bring up words of an Anti-Federalist and it's like, well, who are they? Or, well, we don't care what they have to say because they lost. That basically where it's at, to where if you stop and read what those Anti-Federalists were saying and their thoughts, you'll find that what they predicted is actually what is happening today. So, I mean, they laid out a roadmap of where, of why we are where we are today.
Well, I could not agree more with that viewpoint. And I, as a matter of fact, I have a little something here I would like to read. And this came from one of my favorite Anti-Federalists, Samuel Bryan. And he predicted what was happening, and he predicted where this Constitution would lead us. Now, I would like to read from Sentinel, and then let's see, was he correct, or were Madison and Hamilton correct? So here is what Sentinel had to say. For years past, the harpies of power have been industriously inculcating the idea that all our difficulties proceed from the impotency of Congress, and have at length succeeded to give to this sentiment almost universal currency and belief. The devastations, losses, and burdens occasioned by the late war, the excessive importation of foreign merchandise and luxuries, which have drained the country of its specie and involved in its debt, are all overlooked, and the inadequacy of the powers of the present Confederation is erroneously supposed to be the only cause of our difficulties. Hence, persons of every description are reveling in the anticipation of the Halcyon days, consequent on the establishment of this new Constitution. What gross deception and fatal delusion. Although very considerable benefit might be derived from strengthening the hands of Congress so as to enable them to regulate commerce and counteract the adverse restrictions of other nations, which would meet with the concurrence of all persons, yet this benefit is accompanied in the new Constitution with the scourge of despotic power that will render the citizens of America tenants at will of every species of property, of every enjoyment and make them the mere drudges of government. The gilded bait conceals corrosives that will eat up their whole substance." Unquote. Look around us today. Who was right, James Madison and the Federalist, or our good friend Samuel Bryan? Cal?
Oh, Samuel Bryan was right. Can I point out that that would apply to if Samuel Bryant was talking about the Communist Manifesto as well?
Exactly.
I mean, you talked about, giving up, regulation. They're going to regulate, they're going to delegate the power to regulate commerce. I mean, that's part and parcel. That's communism, period. That's socialism, straight up. And that's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, straight up. Mm-hmm. Socialist, communism. It was written before, socialism, the term socialism was invented. It was the reaction to mercantilism as opposed to the world after the Industrial Revolution. I don't know. I don't see how people don't see that. It's a blueprint for communism. I'm sorry.
You could go to Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, which was the very beginning of that socialism. That Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 is the absolute epitome of socialism 101.
Oh, it is. And the anti-federalists continually pointed out that this was the power of unlimited taxation. Yet you speak to anybody today and they say, oh, no, the power isn't unlimited. Where's the limit? Where is the restriction? It's, whatever's necessary and proper to whatever Congress critters can dream up in their head is necessary and proper. That is no limit. It's to whatever they can imagine they could tax you for. That's what it says.
I just want to add, Cal, that you're making such a great couple of points there. It's amazing people can't see this for the power grab it really is. But, necessary and proper makes it sound like, oh, well, it's necessary and proper. I mean, it's very lawyery and very, that can't be so bad. But when you actually unravel the meaning of the words, it means pretty much whatever they want.
That's exactly what it means. Oh, yeah. And then they get supremacy, to say, well, there's nothing you could do about it. So I do not, other than knowing that the Federalists stacked the ratification conventions, I don't understand how it ever passed, how it was ever ratified. If the Federals had to have stacked the ratification conventions, plus they had those two aces in the hole. They had the accedence of Washington and Franklin on it.
Well, absolutely. But guys, let's delve into that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. The very first power that the Federalists put in the Constitution, the very first power they gave to Congress. And let me read that for you. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Okay, that's what the Constitution said. But now let's look at one of my other favorite anti-federalists, a fellow by the name of Luther Martin. Now, when they proposed this, when they proposed this Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, Luther Martin jumps to his feet. It's recorded. Jumps to his feet, and he opposes Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. And he states the following. Now, I'm going to read through this slowly. He says, "By the power to lay and collect imposts, they may impose duties on any and every article of commerce imported into these states to whatever amount they please. By the power to lay excises, a power very odious in its nature, since it authorizes officers to go into your houses, your kitchens, your cellars, and to examine into your private concerns, the Congress may impose duties on every article of use or consumption, on the food that you eat, on the liquor that you drink, on the clothes that you wear, the glass which enlightens your houses, or the hearths necessary for our warmth and comfort. By the power to lay and collect taxes, they may proceed to direct taxation on every individual, either by a capitation tax on your heads or an assessment on your property. By this part of the section, therefore, the government has a power to lay what duties they please on goods imported, to lay what duties they please afterwards on whatever you use or consume, to impose stamp duties to what amount they please and in whatever case they please, afterwards to impose on the people direct taxation by capitation tax or by assessment to whatever amount they choose, and thus to sluice them at every vein as long as they have a drop of blood, without any control, limitation, or restraint. While all the officers for collecting these taxes, stamp duties, imposts, and excises are to be appointed by the federal government under its direction and not accountable to the states. Now, when we talk about that, Cal, you and I both have encountered these people, these constitutional attorneys and professors who say unequivocally there are no limits to taxation. That is false. But they are lying, because what I just read from Luther Martin perfectly details the taxation we face today. He said they can tax everything you touch. Well, now tell me something that we consume that is not taxed.
Exactly.
So the anti-federalists, and you know, every time I think of that phrase, I can't help but think of Elbridge Gerry, and he was a Yankee, but I give him, you know, a pass on being a Yankee. But Elbridge Gerry said it very succinctly. He said, it's not the Federalist and the anti-Federalist, it's the rats and the anti-rats. Any thoughts out there, Dave?
Well, I think you guys are just nailing it. It's interesting, you know, really the taxation isn't limited. Let's just fast forward to today. Like you said, there's really nothing that it's consumed that isn't taxed. And they're always looking for a new tax to put on people on top of that. And I do have a question, though. When this all started, the primary means of taxation was essentially tariffs, was it not? And when did that change? Was that in 1913 that changed, or when did they really start taxing other things other than using tariffs?
Well, it was called an impost in the beginning. That was the only form of taxation. And, you know, then there is, you know, if I can find it here, it shouldn't take but a moment, but there is a fantastic thing which we can look at. And that would be second inaugural address of Thomas Jefferson. And that is very critical. And Thomas Jefferson, once he took over, now remember, you had Federalist leadership in all branches of government up until 1800. Jefferson was elected 1800, became president in 1801. And in his second inaugural address, and I'll find the words here shortly, but Jefferson was boastful of the fact that no American anywhere saw a tax gatherer. He had cut the size of government, which he did. He eliminated a lot of bureaucratic positions. And he said that everything that we do can be paid for by an impost. Everything this government does can be paid for by an impost. And he went to detail saying that then the people who will pay for this government will be the people who can best afford it. The people who can afford the fancier things will pay more taxes. And that has been completely inverted now because they've created tax codes to where the wealthy pay nothing in many respects.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, the taxation, ironically, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, the first power given to the U.S. Congress established a socialistic empire. Because I promise you, if you told a group of people, you brought them in, you said, okay, we're going to form a group. We're going to be this great kumbaya. We're going to be a great group of people. But one of the provisions is I can take anything you own or any amount of your money at any time I want to and spend it on anything I want to, and you have very little say-so in what I do. Now, how many people would agree to stay with that group, or how many people would say, I'm out of here, Jack? That's exactly what the Constitution said, right, Cal?
Yeah, that's exactly what it said. And most of the people go, sure, let's do it. Let me vote for more of it. Like I say, there's a disconnect, a concrete mind, something that people just can't connect the dots. Just can't see the picture.
Well, guys, I brought up something last night on another program. And I think we have found our way right into that subject here. And if people want to see the conflict of this, and would both of you gentlemen, both of you are well-read, would you call the Revolutionary War a war brought about by a tax revolt?
Not completely. It played into it.
Okay. What would you say the war was fought if it wasn't about taxes?
Back then the thought was you can't tax me unless I have representation. So that's why the House of Burgess until Patrick Henry came along were pretty much okay with the Stamp Act. It's like, well, you know, hey, this is what they're going to do. And Patrick Henry says, not no, but hell no, this ain't right. It was fought because the people felt that their rights were being trampled on. I mean, I guess some people feel that the government has a right to part of your labor, I guess. But that's
them. What about the Boston Tea Party? What was that about?
That was a protest over a tax on tea. It was over the, not so much the 3%, but over the principle of the taxation to begin with. It was, you know, you don't have the right to tax us on this.
Okay.
Well, so, Mike,
it was more on principle as opposed to over the financial burden of it. Because actually that tea would have been less expensive than what they were smuggling in at the time. It was over the principle of you don't have the right to do this to us. The people didn't want to become subject so much to the king. They wanted to be subject to the king, but not subjected to the king, at least not without a say.
Go ahead, Dave.
Didn't the forced quartering of British soldiers at least play into like a lot of hostile feelings towards the British that helped lead to the revolution?
Well, of course it did. But could you not call that a tax on the people?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually saying you don't really own your house. You have to put a British soldier up in it whenever we tell you to. So, yeah.
And you have to feed them and whatever they need, you provide them at no remuneration.
Right.
So that
yeah, so is, it is a tax. That's true.
That's a tax.
Yeah. Well, Mike, basically it comes down to the government or the crown at that time claiming a right to the fruits of your labor.
Well, that is true.
And if an entity claims the rights to the fruit of my labor, then they are my master and I am their slave. Especially if I don't consent to it.
Well,
so
exactly.
Basically it is a form of slavery. It's a form of servitude. I mean, I don't understand how people don't get that. I mean, where does the government get the right to take the fruits of my labor? In natural law, I don't see how that plays into effect.
Okay. At what point, and I believe both of you would agree with me, that Patrick Henry lit the fire that became the American Revolution, and he lit that fire in the Virginia House of Burgesses over the Stamp Act. Would you guys agree or disagree?
No, he lit the fuse. He lit the fuse.
Okay, so then we end up in a war with England, and who was the commander of our Revolutionary Army?
George Washington.
All right, who was his top aide?
Well, one of them was Alexander Hamilton.
Okay, and if you do a real in-depth study of Hamilton and Washington, you will find out that Washington was continually heavily influenced by Hamilton.
Definitely.
And that Hamilton actually wrote most of Washington's speeches.
Hamilton actually kind of ran the government.
Well, that is true. And I'm going to get to that in just a second. But our army, which fought against England, was led by Hamilton and Washington. So then when we get to the Constitutional Convention, who was the leader of the Federalists at the Constitutional Convention?
Washington.
Washington, Hamilton, and of course, Madison.
Yep.
Okay. So then they created a constitution. So then we get to Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution. There was quite a discussion in the Congress over that provision. And the discussion was, at what point does the federal government have the right to intervene into the activities of a state? And there was much debate, much discussion, and they decided on the fact that the only time the federal government could intervene into the actions of a state was if requested to do so by the legislature, and if the legislature wasn't seated, that they would be brought in by the governor. So that was agreed. Then the Federalist Alexander Hamilton, I can't remember what number it is, maybe it's 19, the Federalist 19, but Hamilton writes about this, stating the states have absolutely nothing to fear from the federal government because they can't interfere with the operations in a state unless they are requested to do so by the people of the state. Okay, so the Constitution is ratified. We start a new government under the Constitution, 1789. 1791, Alexander Hamilton sits as the Secretary of the Treasury. So Hamilton pushes through a bill in Congress, which the Secretary of Treasury is not supposed to do, but Hamilton did it. So he pushes through a bill to place a tax on whiskey in all the states. Now, people today would say, and I've encountered one of these people yesterday who said, well, what's wrong with taxing whiskey? What's wrong with that? To support the state. You know, you can choose to buy whiskey or you can choose not to. Well, that is someone who doesn't understand the dynamics of 1791. Whiskey was almost a cash crop of the farmers and the people on the lower end of the economic scale. Whiskey was what they used for barter. Whiskey was their trade. And the people who consumed whiskey were mostly of the lower echelon. But Hamilton did not place a tax on wine or brandy or expensive type liquors, which were the favorite of the wealthy and the well-born. the people in the States saw this, and they saw what it was, and they rebelled against it, most notably in Pennsylvania. Now, Cal, do you know who the governor of Pennsylvania was at the time?
No, who was it?
Thomas Milliken. And Thomas Milliken had been a captain during the Revolutionary War. He had been a highly honored veteran, cited for his valor. He was the governor of Pennsylvania. So Pennsylvania is closest to the capital at that time in Philadelphia or New York. They rotated back and forth for a time. So Hamilton goes to Washington and he says, we can't put up with this. Now, the thing that isn't publicized, guys, is that this whiskey rebellion was taking place in Virginia, in Georgia, and in other places as well. But it was quite vocal in Pennsylvania. So Hamilton goes to Washington and he says, look, let's put together an army and let's go in and put a stop to this whiskey rebellion. And Washington says, well, let me ask John Jay, my Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. John Jay tells Washington, I'm sorry, but you can't do this. Article 4, Section 4, the only way you can go in to put down that rebellion is if you are requested to by the legislature or the governor of Pennsylvania. So this stymies Hamilton, makes Hamilton angry. So Hamilton goes to James Wilson, who is the senator from Pennsylvania. I mean, not a senator from Pennsylvania, but was from Pennsylvania. And he is on the Supreme Court. He's not the Chief Justice, but he is on the Supreme Court. And Hamilton entices Wilson. And Wilson had been involved in many of Hamilton's financial schemes, including the Bank of North America with Robert Morris. So Hamilton goes to James Wilson and says, will you please tell the president that it's constitutional to invade the state of Pennsylvania to collect taxes? And guess what? He did. So Hamilton is made a major general. He's also Secretary of Treasury, and that's a little weird there in that respect too. But he's made a major general, and he and Washington lead an army into Pennsylvania to put down a tax revolt with an army larger than Washington ever commanded during the Revolutionary War. So they go in. The tax revolt is very easily put down. Hamilton wants to hang all of the leaders of this tax revolt. Washington, after they were arrested, he pardons them all. I got to give him credit for that.
On what basis did Hamilton want to hang him? For insurrection or?
Yes, that was exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted them to set as an example. Plus, you have to remember, he also, I believe, I can't prove this, there's no documents for this, but I believe he thought if we hang these guys in Pennsylvania, we'll shut these other people up in Georgia, Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and these other places. We'll shut them up, too, if we hang these guys.
Yeah, used fear to, yeah, exactly.
So, but Washington didn't agree. So, here is what I think is the height of hypocrisy. Washington and Hamilton lead an army to fight against excessive taxation. And then a decade later, lead an army into a state unconstitutionally, lead an army into a state to put down a tax rebellion. To me, that speaks volumes, guys. Any thoughts?
But the government that created by the Constitution became the same tyrannical form of government that the crown was back during the revolution. Is they've just replaced the monarchy with the monarchy with an oligarchy with the powers of a monarchy intentionally.
Under a better name, a more malleable and likable name, I think. And the only other thing I more palatable name, exactly. And the only other thing I'd add is that, you know, this Whiskey Rebellion, you know, it's interesting how it sort of continued with the revenuers and making, you know, destroying people's stills and, you know, ruining people's lives because they were making so-called moonshine. And essentially that it's like Mike described, that was a means of barter and a way for country folk to make extra money. And it turned into a monopoly for the government in the end.
That's called precedent. They set a precedent. And that that's what Patrick Henry was speaking out against on the Stamp Act, was if you let this happen, you're going to set a precedent and it's just going to continue to get worse. That's the fuse he lit, not to let that precedent happen.
Okay. Great point on the precedent. And now let me back that precedent up a little bit. What president cited Washington and Hamilton going in to put down the Whiskey Rebellion? What president cited that as a precedent for him invading states to impose his will?
King Abraham.
King Abe the First, exactly. Yeah. Abraham Lincoln actually cited that when he was questioned about the constitutionality of raising troops to invade the South. That is the exact precedent he pointed to, and he said, if it was good enough for Washington, it's good enough for me.
And didn't Lincoln create all kinds of new taxes to pay for this war?
Well, he had to, Dave, to pay the international bankers. Because when he went to the international, he and Salmon P. Chase went to the international bankers in 1862 when they figured out this was going to be a long-term war and they didn't have the money. When they went to the international bankers said, sure, guys, we'll be happy to loan you all of the money you need at 30 to 40% interest. So that's when Lincoln came up with the greenback on suggestion from his friend in Texas. He came up with the idea of a greenback and, hey, let's just put money out there and it will be backed by the government and nobody has to pay interest on it.
But well, Mike, you can't do that.
Well, exactly. The international bankers went kind of bat crap crazy and said, they go in and they are able to buy off a politician. And gosh, we know that never happens in America. They were able to buy off Salmon P. Chase and then give him enough money. And I've read that it was in the neighborhood of $500,000 to buy enough legislators to make sure that they did away with the greenback because they couldn't make any money from it. Now, all of this is out there in the Hazard Circular. So it is available that this actually happened. But the bankers knew that if the United States could print money on its own, man, they weren't going to make a damn thing on this war. A war which they most probably were involved in pushing.
Right. And like you like to say, Mike, that would let the cat out of the bag, wouldn't it?
Yep, big time. So they came up with the Hazard Circular, which they sent to all of the banks and throughout the country. Pardon me. So I need to get a drink of water here, guys. So can either of you gentlemen think of any time in recent history, and I mean recent in pardon me, recent in the past 50 years to where the United States government has gone into a state to meddle in a state's business without the request of the governor or the legislature?
They meddle in the affairs of the state all the time.
Can you think of two prominent times in my history? I'm not sure that you gentlemen would remember, but what about when Dwight Eisenhower sent federal troops into Little Rock, Arkansas?
Yeah.
What about when the federal troops were sent into Alabama to oppose George Wallace? We'll be back at you on the other side, folks. Thanks for tuning in to Dare to Think Out Loud.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Be evasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, and there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch The Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's The Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
If you think for one second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Oh, well, here we are today, beginning hour two of Dare to Think, damn it. Dare to Think Out Loud. I'm sorry. A little Freudian slip there. And we have been discussing taxes, wars on taxes, hypocrisy among leaders, especially those that we refer to as our founding Federalists. So, and those who oppose them, who were the anti-Federalists. And I believe that they too should be considered as founders. But as we came to an end on the last, came to the close on the last hour, I mentioned the Hazard Circular, and I would like to actually read that for you. It's not that long. Pardon me. And the Hazard Circular, which was sent to all of the banks in the United States when Lincoln had put out the greenback. So the Hazard Circular says, slavery is likely to be abolished by the war power, and chattel slavery abolished. This I and my European friends are in favor of, for slavery is but the owning of labor and carries with it the care of labor, while the European plan, led on by England, is that capital shall control labor by controlling wages. The great debt that capitalists will see to it is made out of the Civil War must be used to control the value of money. To accomplish this, the government bonds must be used as a banking basis. We are now waiting for the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States to make this recommendation. It will not do to allow greenbacks, as they are called, to circulate as money for any length of time, as we cannot control that. But we can control the bonds, and through them, the bank issues. Unquote. So, you know, we can discern from the Hazard Circular that Secretary Chase was being manipulated or controlled by the banking cartel, as I mentioned before. While there are those on the left and the right who deny the existence of the Hazard Circular and the cabals, the financial international bankers' control of Salmon P. Chase, and by default, control of Abraham Lincoln, you must ask yourself, did the events as predicted in the circular actually happen? Facts are history. Secretary Chase proposed and supported the National Banking Acts of 1863 and 1864. Secretary Chase, realizing the necessity of collecting taxes in order to continue the war of aggression on the people and property of the South, also created the Bureau of Internal Revenue, or what we commonly refer to today as the IRS. So there again, we have how international bankers have moved in to control the events in this country, much as they are controlling exactly the events that we are looking at today. The ones we're staring right dead in the face. So any comment, Cal?
Well, just to point out that all of this was made possible by Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1.
Unlimited taxation from unlimited sources. Let me see. Is that does that coincide with Plank 2 of the Communist Manifesto, my friend?
Yep.
And then if we're going to get everyone to be just insanely stupid, then we would have to revert to Plank 10 of the Communist Manifesto, would we not?
Exactly.
So, people, are we just absolutely that damn stupid in the fact that in this country today, there is a government alphabet bureaucracy in place to enforce all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto and not one damn agency out there to protect the rights of the people? How much more information do you need before you realize the Constitution and your alleged Bill of Rights will get you nothing, just like what you're sitting on today? Go ahead, Cal.
I was just, you brought up some examples, such as when they sent the National Guard into Alabama, but how about when the FBI and ATFE invaded Randy Weaver's place or at Waco?
Exactly.
There was no call from the legislator of Texas or the governor of Texas or the legislature of Idaho or the governor of Idaho for any of those actions. Yeah, they're the federal sheriffs, the standing army. There it was.
Well, did anybody in Utah summon the feds to come to Clive and Bundy?
No. Well, that was in Nevada, and the governor went along with it. Sandoval could have. I lived in Nevada at that time. I know that era real well. Sandoval could have done and should have done more and didn't. The state could have stopped it. I mean, the governor of Utah actually stopped the federal government from shipping the cattle they rustled from Bundy into Utah. That's why they ended up being sold down in Bakersfield, because they shipped one load up into Utah, and the governor said, next time you do that, I'm arresting everybody who is involved with it.
What so governor was that?
Governor Herbert, I think that's his name, yeah, from Utah. Yeah, he said, you're not going to ship any more cattle into my state. I mean, there are ports of entry. There is a cattle brand inspection station about 40 miles south of Bunkerville, Nevada, which they would have had to drove those cattle through, which the governor of Nevada, Sandoval, could have said, hey, could have sent his stormtroopers, the Nevada Highway Patrol, to have intercepted any of those cattle being rustled, because that's exactly what the government did. They rustled those cattle away from Clive and Bundy.
And did they ever reimburse him?
No. No, they never reimbursed him. They still think he owes them money. They stole the cattle from him. That's straight up cattle rustling. And I'm not sure if they ever updated the laws in Nevada to where cattle rustling isn't a hangable offense. I don't know. Maybe they've gotten a little politically correct and have updated it, but seems to me that those people involved in it were involved in cattle rustling, and if there was justice, they'd have been hung for those crimes. That's just my opinion. I have this penchant against government and people who operate in government.
Well, as Mark Twain said, no amount of evidence will ever persuade an idiot.
Yeah.
So we have that, and of course, you know, like you said, Cal, you brought up some other incidents, which are great, great examples. But, gosh, if I were to read you guys something, and then let's see if you could tell me if you would follow this guy. I'm going to read you his actual words. And you tell me if you would follow this man as a leader. I'm not talking about as a politician, although he was a politician. But I want to read you his words, and you tell me what you think of this word of this gentleman based on his words. He said, "People produce wealth, free people, and as they learn, there is little reward for ambition, that it requires faith to risk, and they have none. As the government must restrict and penalize and tax incentive and endeavor and must increase its expenditure of bounties, then this government must assume more and more police powers, and we find we are becoming a government-fearing people, not a God-fearing people. We find we have replaced faith with fear, and though we may give lip service to the Almighty, in reality, the government has become our God. It is therefore basically ungodly government, and its appeal to the pseudo-intellectual and the politician is to change their status from servant of the people to master of the people, to play at being God without faith in God and without the wisdom of God. Its pseudo-liberal spokesman and some Harvard advocates have never examined the logic of its substitution of what it calls human rights for individual rights, for its propaganda play upon words has appeal for the unthinking. Let us send the message to Washington by our representatives who are with us today that from this day we are standing up and the heel of tyranny does not fit an upright man." Unquote. Cal, who was that?
I've read that before, and the name escapes me right now.
Would you believe that man to be a leader?
I would believe those words to be words to live by and consider, yeah.
Dave, what about your thoughts, buddy?
Yeah, I agree. Those are the words of someone that's not messing around. I don't know the name of the man, though.
Would you believe that the government tried to assassinate him?
Most definitely.
Would you believe he has been demonized in history?
I would expect that to happen. Can't speak up for liberty, freedom.
Would you believe his name was George Wallace?
That is true. That was when he was talking about segregation. I knew that name. I've heard that. It was George Wallace, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, here's a little bit more from the same speech. And I quote, "It is an idea of government that encourages our fears and destroys our faith. For where there is faith, there is no fear. And where there is fear, there is no faith. In encouraging our fears of economic insecurity, it demands we place that economic management and control with government. In encouraging our fear of educational development, it demands that we place that education and the minds of our children under the management and control of government. And even feeding our fears of physical infirmities and declining years, it offers and demands to father us through it all and even into the grave. It is a government that claims to us that it is bountiful as it buys its power from us with the fruits of its rapaciousness of the wealth that free men before it have produced and builds on crumbling credit without responsibility to the debtors, our children." Unquote. How relevant is that to exactly what we're going through right now, gentlemen?
He knew what the game was, didn't he, when it came to debt?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt that he had that figured out. He saw it coming. And, pardon me. Here is something that most people, you know, this is ancient history now. George Wallace was shot in Maryland in May of 1972 by Arthur Bremer. The circumstances around this attempted assassination, the growing popularity of Wallace's message, the possible involvement of several government agencies and President Nixon's plumbers, who would later become famous in the conspiracy that was Watergate, and the circumstances of the mysterious death of J. Edgar Hoover just weeks before make for very interesting reading. So here is something to stop and think about. Now, Bremer assassinated or attempted the assassination. He shot Wallace. That's pretty evident. The income tax returns found in Bremer's apartments after his arrest shows a previous year's income of $1,611. Remember that he had to pay for rent and food out of that amount. In the months before the assassination attempt, Bremer paid cash for a car, paid for a plane ticket to New York, where he stayed at the Waldorf Astoria, drove back and forth to Ottawa, Canada, where he stayed at the Lord Elgin, where coincidentally the U.S. Secret Service was staying at the time. He bought three firearms, took a helicopter ride in New York City, paid for a chauffeured limousine, and tipped a lady who gave him a massage $30. How do you do that on $1,611 income, guys?
That's fascinating. You know, I didn't realize that J. Edgar Hoover's death was so closely coincided with the attempt on Wallace.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy the way history, especially the parts we aren't taught about very well. It's kind of funny how that continues, isn't it? How things play in.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting too about the way they frame the whole conversation about, you know, so-called segregation, really, because you're talking about the federal government coming in and demanding that states behave a certain way. And one thing about freedom is that some people are going to make choices that you don't necessarily like. And that's when people want to use big government to force the behavior of other people.
Well, Dave and Cal, you know, one of the things I think that just absolutely scared the crap out of the federal government with George Wallace?
What's that?
Well, if you will go back and look at the records, they called him a racist. They called him all kinds of things. They did all of the federal government went on a character assassination of George Wallace. Yet in the elections for governor, George Wallace carried the vast majority of the black vote in Alabama.
Wow, I did not know that.
So they thought that they would destroy him by calling him a racist, first and foremost. And that didn't work. And then he began to gather steam as a presidential candidate. I'm trying to think, was it which election? That the previous election, and at the time he was shot in 72, he was ahead in the presidential campaign of even Robert Kennedy, if I'm not mistaken. No, not Robert Kennedy. Well, maybe it was. But anyway, he was the head. He was leading. But while all of the government lapdogs, both in and out of the media, demonized George Wallace for being racist, their true fear was his growing popularity among the common man and woman in America, both black and white. Historically, the power elite feared that awakening.
Well, Mike, you know, what's interesting is that if he got most of the black vote, that meant that the black people in Alabama wanted to be free to decide how they were going to proceed, not being forced by the federal government. That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I forgot how many. I'm trying to find it now. And, well, yes. In 1968, George Wallace garnered 10 million votes in his quest for the presidency, running on the American Independent Party ticket. Wallace carried 5 southern states with the attendant 45 electoral votes. Wallace's realistic goal was to gain enough electoral votes to throw the election into the House of Representatives. That's in 68. But then in 72, he was running again, but he was running as a party. Now, true, everyone. Now, here's the thing that bothers me. George Wallace was demonized for this part of his speech. Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever. So he was always branded as a racist and a bigot in the media for that part of his speech. But what did the Supreme Court say in Plessy v. Ferguson? You remember, Cal?
No, what did they say?
Separate but equal.
That would be segregation.
Exactly. Plus, guys, here is something. Now, we say that, you know, segregation is wrong, segregation is racist, and everything else. So here, I've got a question. If one group or race of people has a month set aside to honor their history when others do not, is that segregation? Yeah. If one group or race of people is allowed to form a congressional caucus exclusive for their race, religion, or ethnicity, is that not segregation? If one group or race of people is allowed to have a college fund designated specifically for members of their race or group, does that not constitute segregation? If a group or race of people can establish chambers of commerce specifically to address issues relative to their group or race, does that not constitute segregation? If a group or race of people is allowed to form an association that specifically addresses advancement of their race or group, does that not constitute segregation? If a group or race of people have institutions of higher learning that cater specifically to their own race to the exclusion of others, is this not segregation?
It does. It also illustrates the necessity in hypocrisy in viewing people by race to begin with, instead of just as your fellow human being. It's just a different form of tribalism. It's a different form of separation. In rightful liberty, the color of a person's skin is irrelevant, because all men are created equal. Color and race is irrelevant in understanding true rightful liberty.
Well, I can't argue with that and wouldn't even attempt to, because I agree with it totally and wholeheartedly. But who promotes the separation of the races in this country?
The government. They have to. It's part of the hypocrisy.
Well, part of the thing I have said from day one, guys, is that neither race or group of people are profit from hating the people in the other group or race or ethnicity or religion or what have you. Divisiveness is the tool of the government. Because if we're busy being angry at each other, we're not paying attention to what the government's doing to all of us.
Yeah, that's right. I totally agree, Mike. They need that tool, because if people ever realize who the true enemy is, which is this federal government, that's their biggest fear. So, yeah, they're constantly ginning up racial hatred and racial division every single day. And they use the media as their tool for this.
Well, you know what really just cracks me up is this new hate crime thing for Asian Americans. And I stop and think, wasn't it that wonderful Democrat, and of course, Democrat, Republican doesn't make any difference, but he was a Democrat. Wasn't it the wonderful Democrat FDR that took thousands of Chinese and put them in concentration camps in World War II?
Japanese, yeah. War tribalism.
And Italians were rounded up too, but they don't talk about that much.
No, that is true as well.
Yeah.
So the hypocrisy of government, guys, is just, to me, out of, I don't know. But why do people, and I asked this question last night, I can't get an answer. Why do people continue to pay attention, to place faith in this government? Why will millions of people put on a mask and restrict their intake of oxygen and take a jab or a vaccine that might be that might kill them and take their children to get that vaccine when the children don't need it? Why will the people continue with 230 years, 30 plus years of proof of the hypocrisy, the deception, and the deceit of this government? Why do people still follow it blindly? Cal?
Because the people no longer have a love for liberty. Hey, they want security. I mean, there's no guarantees of security and liberty other, but the government can come along and surrender your liberty and we'll give you security. And you will end up with neither, just as Franklin said. That's exactly what's going on. People have lost that understanding and love for liberty.
Well, I certainly can't argue that point at all.
I think that's partly true because with liberty comes responsibility, and that scares people. They'd rather be taken care of than be free.
Responsibility is one of the cornerstones of liberty.
Well, I certainly couldn't argue that point. Talking with a friend in Arkansas this morning and came up with a quote. He asked me about something and I provided him with this quote. Guys, see if you can think through your history and see if you can say who made this quote. Of all the evils to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops every other. War is the patent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied. And all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Unquote. Cal?
I'm trying to think of who stated. I've read that before. I could not tell you who wrote that.
Would you say it's true?
Oh, yeah, definitely true.
Dave?
Oh, absolutely, 100% true. I don't know who said it, though. It's certainly words of wisdom.
Well, it comes under the heading of even a blind squirrel finds an acorn every once in a while, because those were the words of James Madison.
Even a blind squirrel finds an acorn. That's a good one.
Well, that's how you sell a lie, is you feed it with truth. The best swindles in history are, started with the truth. You start with the truth, the people believe you, And then they just follow everything else you say. That's why it's more of following what is said as opposed to follow the leader, as in following the individual themselves. Because even Lincoln said this country was founded, conceived in liberty. That's a truth. Does that mean I should follow Lincoln? I mean, I guess it's part of that cult of personality where people follow other people instead of following their own minds and hearts, or hearts and minds. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it does. I've been having some crazy thoughts today, so I want to run another one by you guys. What if I am a foreign military? I am a captain or a major, and I have some troops under my command. And what if I take those troops, put them in civilian clothes, put them in boats, and cross into your country, and then take over one of your state buildings? Is that an act of war or not?
Yes.
Dave?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
When did that happen in history, guys?
I don't know.
Would you believe that is what Major Anderson did when he moved from Fort Moultrie to Fort Sumter in the Charleston Harbor?
So that was the initiation of an act of war.
That was, and ironically, Fort Sumter was a revenue collection point. So then we are told, though, that the South initiated the war by firing on Fort Sumter. So the South firing cannons at its own fortress because it had been inhabited by soldiers of another country surreptitiously is an act of war. See what happens in this crazy head of mine? I get these things happen to me, wake me up sometime.
You should do a show on John Brown sometime, Mike. That'd be a great show.
Oh, John Brown. Yes. Ooh. Gosh, could we take him into bloody Kansas? Would we want to tell the people how he slaughtered people in Kansas? Would we want to tell people that when he took over, the armory, that the first person he killed was a free black man at Harper's Ferry? The truths of history are a bitch.
Yeah, it's not that George Washington cut down the cherry tree mythology, is it?
No, and Abe Lincoln, the rail splitter. Yeah.
Honest
poor,
Abe, yeah.
Poor rail splitter, Honest Abe. You know what really gets to me is the fact that it's common history. It's pretty well known that he admits that he shared a bed with Joshua Speed. I think that was his first name. He shared a bed with a man for over a year, but people get very upset when you mention that Lincoln might have been a homosexual.
Well, I think it was kind of well known in certain circles, wasn't it, at the time?
Well, his law partner, William Herndon, didn't have any problems alluding to that fact. And didn't he cancel a wedding because of Mr. Speed?
I didn't know that they shared a bed for an entire year. That's
oh, yes.
And, yeah, that's the first I've heard that.
Yeah, they admitted it. Lincoln admitted it.
Well, they were just sleeping, Mike. Come on.
Oh, okay.
That's certainly not normal.
Yeah, well, It reminded me of something very funny. If you guys, of course, I've lost all respect for her over the years, last couple of years, but you guys ever listen to Dolly Parton talk about growing up in East Tennessee?
No.
She said they had, you know, that in the wintertime there was cracks in the walls and snow would actually blow through around the windows, and that she and her that she and her brothers and sisters would oftentimes have to sleep together in the same bed, and they would take turns peeing to keep each other warm.
That's just survival, Mike. Come on.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying it wasn't survival. I just thought it was a funny story. And I remember two incidents with her. I went to a concert one time, and she opened for Marty Robbins. And she had just left Porter Wagoner, and she left. Well, I'm going to get into some rather touchy areas here, but Marty Robbins made a fantastic joke. He said that he dreamed, he told one of his band members after Dolly had done the opening, he told one of his band members, he said, "You know what, guys, last night I had a nightmare." One of his band members says, "All right, Marty, what was that?" And he said, "I dreamed I was a baby. Dolly Parton was my mother, and they put me on the bottle."
That's funny.
But that was back when you could be funny, you know, and not be insensitive.
Yeah, people's skin's a little bit thin these days.
Yeah, wasn't it Johnny Carson who introduced Dolly Parton one time, and he said, "Here, ladies and gentlemen, is the lady from East Tennessee, from the mountains of East Tennessee," and she brought two of them with her.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well,
we're living in a culture of victimhood anymore. Everybody's offended by what everybody thinks, says, or does anymore. Everybody's a victim of other people's thoughts.
Well, we broke down a little bit there, and it was all my fault. We broke down from the anti-federalists. We probably should jump back to there and quit talking about Dolly Parton. Cal, who was your favorite anti-federalist?
Well, that would be Patrick Henry.
Oh, okay. And Patrick Henry was oratory more than written, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, what about the anti-federalists? I mean, let's look at a couple of things. Just right after the Constitution comes out, we end up with quite a few started in November of 1787. And so I thought, who was the guy who wrote Anti-Federalist as a Federalist, Cal? Do you remember?
Was he a Virginian?
No, it was posted in the Boston Gazette and Country Journal in November of 1787, his writings were.
Let's see. So he's from Massachusetts. Elbridge Gerry?
I was thinking it might have been Samuel Adams.
We don't
know, but I was thinking, and now listen to what he said, and I quote, "The hideous demon of aristocracy has hitherto had so much influence as to bar the channels of investigation, preclude the people from inquiry, and extinguish every spark of liberal information of its qualities. At length, the luminary of intelligence begins to beam its effulgent rays upon this important production. The deceptive mist cast before the eyes of the people by the delusive machinations of its interested advocates begins to dissipate as darkness flies before the burning taper." Could that have been Mercy Otis Warren?
That's what I was just going to say. That sounds like Mercy Otis Warren to me.
Yeah, that
she had that flowery flow to her writings.
Yeah, that
sounds so much like her.
I agree. That sounds more like her than Samuel Adams.
Oh yeah, that doesn't have the Samuel Adams had an abruptness to him. That was flowing. That was
let me read
it, a little. It was her, or it was, you know, someone related to her.
Well, let me read a little bit more of that, and let's see if we think it was her. It said, those furious zealots who are for cramming it down the throats of the people without allowing them either time or opportunity to scan or weigh it in the balance of their understandings bear the same marks in their features as those who have long been wishing to erect an aristocracy. I'm thinking Mercy Otis Warren here.
Yeah.
And continuing with that, and it says, as the plan now offered comes something near their wishes and is the most consonant to their views of any they can hope for, they come boldly forward and demand its adoption. They brand with infamy every man who is not as determined and zealous in its favor as themselves. They cry aloud, the whole must be swallowed or none at all, thinking thereby to preclude any amendment. They are afraid of having it abated of its present rigid aspect. Hmm. Yeah, I'm still thinking Mercy Otis Warren there.
No, that sounds like her. This is under what pseudonym?
A Federalist.
A Federalist.
Mm-hmm. Now, she wrote as the Columbian Patriot.
I was going to say, those two are so familiar, those two writings.
Right. The Columbian Patriot was believed to be Elbridge Gerry for quite some time before it was proved to be Mercy Otis Warren. I'll bet you our favorite constitutional attorney doesn't quote that part of her presentation.
Oh, obviously not. She likes to quote her, but she doesn't quote those parts. She takes it way out of context when she quotes Mercy Otis Warren.
Oh, well, you have to. You absolutely have to. And to continue even a little more, it says, they have strived to overawe or seduce printers to stifle and obstruct a free discussion and have endeavored to hasten it to a decision before the people can duly reflect upon its properties. In order to deceive them, they incessantly declare that none can discover any defect in this system but bankrupts who wish no government and officers of the present government who fear to lose a part of their power. These zealous partisans may injure their own cause and endanger the public tranquility by impeding a proper inquiry. The people may suspect the whole to be a dangerous plan from such covered and designing schemes to enforce it upon them. Cal, have you or Dave ever had the opportunity to read the letters exchanged between John Adams and Mercy Otis Warren after Adams left office as president?
No, I haven't done that.
Well, yes. Might I suggest that you get the opportunity? I have them in a collection. I'll see if I can find them and send them to you. But it is absolutely interesting, very interesting reading, because Mercy Otis Warren slices and dices John Adams, I mean, just incessantly, and he keeps trying to come back and trying to get the best of her, and she just... and. At one time, they were good friends. But she cuts him to pieces. It's just absolutely... As a matter of fact, we ought to do a program on that one time, Cal.
All right. You know, thanks for the new rabbit hole, Mike. I'll be in that one next week.
Well, you know, you and I both know we've been doing this long enough. The rabbit holes are where you find all the fun stuff.
Well, it's I enjoy these adventures.
You know, I was also thinking of something. Do you remember when Samuel Bryan wrote as Sentinel, and he said, they have told us that if we do not adopt this, and I'm paraphrasing, They have told us that if we do not adopt this new system, that there will be anarchy. And he says, I would prefer anarchy to what they have proposed.
Yeah. Well, there's a similar, you know, intellect between, you know, Bryant and Mercedes Warren and Brutus. Who wrote this Brutus?
That was Robert Yates, I believe.
Robert, yeah. I mean, there's a similarity in the way they wrote. But, you know, each of them in their own little bit unique way, explaining the same thing. They all came to basically the same conclusion, you know, from, you know, examining what was proposed in front of them.
Well, are you familiar with William Grayson?
Yeah, the senator from Virginia. Yes.
Right. Yeah. One of the only two Anti-Federalist senators in the first U.S. Congress.
Yes.
He was one of the few who wrote under his own name. And he was pretty concise. Some of his stuff is very good. He says, there are certain modes of governing the people which will succeed. There are others which will not. The idea of consolidation is abhorrent to the people of this country. There are two opinions prevailing in the world. The one, that mankind can only be governed by force. The other, that they are capable of freedom and a good government. Infuse new strength and spirit into the state governments, for when the component parts are strong, it will give energy to the overall government, although it be otherwise weak. We ought to consider, as Montesquieu says, whether the construction of the government be suitable to the genius and disposition of the people, as well as a variety of other circumstances. Hmm. And do you know who wrote as a Maryland farmer?
That was Mercer.
Yes. Very good. Very, very good.
And, you've got to parse his apart. He wrote on an intellect way up there.
Yeah, that's one of those where you have to take it sentence by sentence, isn't it?
Well, you, and bring a dictionary with you.
Yeah, an 1826 dictionary will certainly help, or an 1800 dictionary will certainly help.
Yes.
So let me see what. Well,
hey, you Mike.
Know, yes, sir.
It's talking about Federalists and Anti-Federalists. I think it's important to note the monarchical tendency of the Federalists, from overtly to, you know, right out, straight up, I'm for a monarchy, such as Hamilton, who was the principal author of the Federalist Papers, as opposed to the Anti-Federalists, who were demanded liberty. You put a meme up a while back. Alexander Hamilton proposed a monarchy. Patrick Henry demanded liberty. Which one do you follow?
Right.
So perhaps people should, you know, investigate for themselves more of the wisdom and writings of the Anti-Federalists. Come away with their own conclusions if they're still able to think.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that and thinking about a sentence from Patrick Henry. He said, as long as we can preserve our unalienable rights, we are safe. Well, we certainly can't preserve them, can we?
No, and the Bill of Rights does not. Sorry, the Constitution. The power to lay taxes for whatever reason they want in the Supremacy Clause takes precedent over your rights. I mean, where in the Bill of Rights does it say that the Bill of Rights take precedent over what was written in the Constitution? It doesn't, but it does say it the other way around in the Constitution, in the original draft of 1787, that it has supremacy, not your rights, that the Constitution and whatever the Congress can dream up is necessary and proper, that has precedence over your rights. That's what the Constitution says. The Bill of Rights is a bill of goods.
Hey, Cal, who wrote as an observer?
An observer. Oh, man, I was just looking that one up, too. You'll have to remind me, Mike.
Well, I don't know. That was a genuine question. I've been trying to figure out who was the observer as well.
Before the show, I was just about to go read something. I just ran across it, and I was like, oh, man, I need to read that. And I haven't had a chance to, so I do not know. The observer. Making another note. Another rabbit hole. Thanks, Mike. I enjoy these challenges. For those who don't know, Mike leads an online course, so to speak, and he constantly has us students going down rabbit holes. Those that wish to do it, you know, are more than welcome to do it. And it's been fun and it's been an adventure. And I can't thank Mike enough for the challenges and for all the wisdom and insight and history he already brings to the table.
Well, thank you, Cal. What I try to do is to get people to discover their own history rather than have me tell it to them.
Exactly. And you know, it's an investment in time and effort and a lot of, you know, refragging your brain from what you were taught to what you're reading is, it takes time to digest what you're learning, you know, all this new learning and all these new understandings of true history, because this is coming from the source documents, from the people that actually participated in it, and not from a textbook written by somebody in 1950 who wants you to think what they want you to think.
Absolutely. And, we're almost running out of time here, guys. Gosh, this has been fun. Dave, you got any parting words?
Great show, Mike. A lot of rabbit holes you took us down in. I really liked ending it on the discussion of the anti-federalists and the people that actually wrote under those names versus their pseudonyms. Excellent.
Well, thanks, Dave. I appreciate all your efforts. Thanks, Cal. I appreciate you coming on. And for those who have taken the time to listen in, I appreciate you guys more than you will ever know. And looks like we're very, very close. Tune in to us on Sunday. Tune into the show on Sunday, Addicted to Your Own Destruction, where we will have a roundtable with Sergeant Jim Ram, Robert Hudson from Nevada, and our good friend Daryl Wayne. And, of course, Dave Scorpio will be with us as well. So thanks, folks. We appreciate you. And thanks so much for taking the time to listen in. And please check with my Telegram site called The Rebel Madman. Goodbye, everyone.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Zero X E 0513.
We talk about this.